I live in Ottawa. My phone number at the office is Central 34021. I went to work as an organizer for the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Transport and General Workers on January 1st, 1917. I have lived in various parts of the country. I've had fairly long stays in Winnipeg, where my children were born. We lived in Toronto for quite a long period of time, and we now, my wife and I now live in Ottawa. I have been a member of my union, of course, from the very beginning. I might say that I am a professional person in the labor movement, not having worked very much on the railway. And when I joined the Brotherhood, I was working in the for the railway department, the Scranton Schools. I was a pioneer in the organizing a Canadian union, which was caused by the fact that there was no international union at that particular time to organize this group of railway workers. And this brought us to the into conflict with the American Federation of Labor. So for the first 30 years of my life, I not only was working to build the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Transport and General Workers, but we did so in spite of all the opposition that the American Federation of Labor could put up against us. I have held the position of organizer. I have been the regional director of organization for the Canadian Labor, for the Canadian Congress of Labor, and I am the vice president, the national vice president of the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Transport and General Workers at the present time. I was a member of the Ontario Regional War Labor Board during the war, active in the fundraising or the of the government and its victory loans and that kind of thing. I've also been active in the in welfare work. I perhaps I shouldn't say this, but after the war, I was made a member of the Order of the British Empire by the Queen, and it's one of those things that you keep hidden in the labor movement. You don't boast about them. I have been a delegate to the Trades and Labor Council in Vancouver and Toronto. I was the president of the Labor Council in Toronto for about 10 years. I was president of the Ontario Federation of Labor, or the CCL, for about 3 years. And if there's any other jobs in the labor movement around, I probably was in those too. I have been delegate to the TLC, Trades and Labor Congress of Canada, in years gone by, and to various types of political conventions and so forth. As I said before, I've been on this job now for 47 years and 7 months, and there's not much room then to have many other employers. I don't know if there's anybody that's got that record beaten anywhere in the country, but now that John Bruce is retired, I probably am the senior labor scape that's in the country, if you let me use that term. I have had nothing to do with any kind of peace work. All our rates of pay were always on a monthly rate or an hourly rate. After we got to the point where we could negotiate a collective agreement. But there was a long, hard battle before you got to that stage because there were much discrimination. On one particular occasion here in Vancouver, there was I had organized the dining car employees of the Canadian Pacific Railway. I think between Winnipeg and Western Canada, there was about 400 or 500 of them, and the CPR fired every one of them except about a half a dozen. There was a board of conciliation established at that time under the chairmanship of Mr. McDonald. The railway company claimed that they had released the men for more important war service, which we knew different. We were fired for joining the union, but the board of conciliation stated that they believed the railway company, they were fired for more important war service, in spite of the fact that some of the people they fired were veterans off the war, and one of them was a member of the Princess Pat with some 100 wounds on him at the time. It was also a time when any efforts of the labor movement was met with much opposition. Organized workers were struggling at all times for recognition of their union. And this was always the big problem. Of course, there was difficulties in the form of political activity in the particularly here in the Labor Council in Vancouver. And on one particular occasion, there was after conscription came into effect, there was all kinds of talk about draft evaders and white feather guys and all the wrong names they could call people. But there was one particular chap by the name of Ginger Goodman. And Ginger Goodman, rather than accept a draft, went over into Vancouver Island. Somewhere or another, he was shot by the mounted police. And of course, the story was that he was shot in the back, which caused a great deal of agitation, and when this matter was brought to the Labor Council here in Vancouver, the workers were very indignant and called a strike, a general strike, the next day to take effect at 12 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, the workers and the activity here in the city faded to a standstill. And I was in the Labor Temple at the time with a chap by the name of Victor Midsley, who was the secretary of the Labor Council. And in the meantime, I think there was an agitation in car supply to bring down a lot of shell-shocked soldiers who had returned from the front. And they gathered in front of that building that's opposite the Dungemere Hotel now, and that was the old Labor Temple there. And when I was upstairs with Midsley, a delegation of these people came up, and when they were let in, asked them what they wanted. They told us they were looking for labor leaders, and we too would do. They attempted to throw us out the window, but Midsley and I managed to get out on the coping of that building, and he went one way and I went the other way. And I managed to get in the office of the Cooks and Waiters and Bartenders Alliance office that was there. And when they finally discovered me in there, they broke down the door, but this time they lugged me down in the into the street and out in the mob, and by this time the police arrived, and the police formed a wedge into the crowd and brought me back to the wall of the building. And needless to say, I've never said a word against a policeman in my life since that time. And this was one of the incidents. Gray was the mayor at the time. I think it was Mayor Gray. And he was appealing to all kinds of difficulties. The longshoremen in their hall were prepared to fight, and they broke up the chairs in their hall, and each one of them got a leg of a chair, and they stood in a solid mass of on their stairway and defied anybody to come in and throw anybody out of there. But that quieted down. And
Who do you think organized these soldiers?
Well, we attributed, of course, to the Board of Trade, or the Canadian Manufacturers Association, or the employer group. This was certainly, we attributed to them, because workers didn't have too many cars to bring these people down. There must be a fairly good historical record in the newspapers.
Yeah, there is. That, it's on that. I was wondering, whether you had any idea how these people, who actually organized your...
I don't know who actually did it. It was just taken for granted that it was the general opposition to the trade union movement, and which was the...
The newspapers had some pretty...
Of course, the newspapers were very patriotic at that time, and they... And I presume that you didn't get too much support of the newspapers for the cause of labor. But it was one of those struggles of the working people to arrive at the stage where we're at today. Now, you want to know something about...
Can we go on this for a moment, with the conscription thing? I was interested in that.
Were you in the Vancouver Labour Council at the time? Were you a local official?
No, I was a national. I was a national organizer for the Brotherhood.
I see.
No. And I was operating all over the country. And at that particular time, I was organizing here in Vancouver. Railway people.
Okay. It seems to me that said that the BC trade union movement was pretty well opposed to conscription, but the national Basin Labor Council wasn't. They were more mild. Can you elaborate on any vast difference?
I would say that the Trades and Labor Congress in Canada at that time, they were not. They did not lack loyalty. They may have been, like the province of Quebec, had some objection to conscription. And perhaps the bringing conscription into the country at that time was not, it was not a popular thing. And it was an act by Sir Robert Borden and his ministers. That created the union government at the time. You see, some liberals were for it, some against it, and some all political parties and different points of view in the country. Now, who was for it, who was against it, pretty hard to say.
What I meant was BC Labor more radical than the on this issue than the rest of the country?
I would say that there was a greater degree of progressive political thinking in BC than there was in Eastern Canada. There was quite a political development in Winnipeg, but BC was probably the most aggressive.
To what extent was the conscription used for strike breaking? You mentioned the one case.
Oh, the conscription issue was strictly a matter of desperation for troops and a desire to make the largest contribution they could possibly make to the struggle of 1914-1918. I think the motives were right, but all the people weren't just prepared to go that far.
The reason I ask this is that there's some comment, particularly in the Fernie area, that the conscription was used, that if the miners went on strike, the union leaders were immediately conscripted.
Because up to that time, there had been no legislation prohibiting strikes. The legislation prohibiting strikes came about when our own particular brotherhood called a general strike of all our members in 1918. And at that time, the flu epidemic was on, and the labor market was at its very low level, and a general strike could have been considered a pretty drastic upset of the economy, the war economy at the time, and particularly in the transportation field. And that was when the government passed legislation prohibiting strikes during the war.
Do you remember why the strike was called?
Which strike? Our strike was called for recognition. And we got recognition of our organization at that time because the government put the onus on the Railway War Board to settle with us so that as well as prohibit that strike. So they met with us and gave us a type of recognition. That is, they agreed to meet what might be called committees of the employees rather than official recognition that we have today. Not that it makes any difference. We still have the same setup today as we had before, even with official recognition, because we have developed our people over the railway company, and they're on many of them are on leave of absence to act as general chairman, and they had got that in 1918, and so that's what our strike was about. Now, with regard to political situations, at that around 1900, and I wouldn't say the dates, there was, of course, the IWW was around the countryside. It wasn't very active particularly. There was the Independent Labor Party at that time. I think that Woodsworth's dates must come about 1919, and there was the Independent Labor Party was in Winnipeg, and they had succeeded in electing some people to the city council. There was no, I think sometime after that, there used to be a Socialist Party of Canada, and I think the Socialist Party of Canada became the Workers' Party, and the Workers' Party became the Communist Party. This is the development of that.
Socialist Party actually split.
Yeah, the Socialist Party split. Some went to the Workers' Party of Canada, and others went to the developing other ways. And this is the development of the political movement. I have always been a member of the Independent Labor Party, and which followed, which was the forerunner of the CCF. I've always supported the CCF and now the New Democratic Party. I've always been convinced that Labour had to have a political arm, even just for no other reason than to challenge the other parties into action and give them competition, as it were, for more progressive legislation. The struggle for recognition of a union developed to the point where there was a strike in the Vulcan Iron Works in Winnipeg for recognition of the union, and there was and prior to that time it was the constant struggle for recognition of a union. That was always the first issue, to recognize the union. And they had a small general strike in one case in Winnipeg to force the recognition of a union. And then that being a bit of a successful weapon, it was tried again in the Vulcan Iron Works to develop a recognition of the union. And I presume that there were people wrong motives, but the great mass of the people were struggling for the one issue, and that was the recognition of the union. And all the talk about the Winnipeg Revolution is in 1919 was pure nonsense. It was just this struggle for recognition off the union of the Vulcan Iron Works. And if they had granted recognition, there wouldn't have been any general strike.
or if they'd conceded to labor the right to organize without being dismissed or discriminated against, you wouldn't have had these issues in 1919. Now, during this period of time, there was tremendous agitation against the American Federation of Labor. For one reason or other, they were not progressive enough in the minds of a lot of people. They were very largely thinking in terms of craft organization, and the idea was rapidly developing that that industrial organization was probably the way the labor movement should develop. And instead of splitting the groups of workers up into about 20 different labor organizations, they should be more or less united in one union. And this was the cause, in my judgment, for a great deal of anti-AFL philosophy that was around Winnipeg. And when the and there was conventions called for the, you know, discuss this issue and so forth. But it was only after the general strike in Winnipeg was called and by the leaders who were part and parcel of the American Federation of Labor. And the one big union came after that strike. And it developed over the countryside in Western Canada from Winnipeg through the various cities. But it did not make the progress in British Columbia that it was able to make in Winnipeg. It was, I think it was fairly stopped here. They just couldn't go east to Toronto. They couldn't go into BC. I think this is where it was confined. And they built the one big union up to about, I think they had one time some 40 or 50,000 members in it. I don't know whether that's correct, but certainly they had a very large membership at its height.
What effect did this have on the CBRT? What effect did it have on the CBRT?
Well, the CBRT, having had so much opposition from the AFL and the efforts made by the AFL to destroy the CBRT, naturally we were always on the side of anybody that was against the AFL. And while we ourselves, of course, from its very beginning, preached industrial organization, and that is that all railway workers should be united into one union. This was the philosophy, even though we didn't carry it into effect. We were out organizing the unorganized railway workers. But I presume because we were an industrial organization in thought, if not indeed, was the reason why the AFL organizations were opposed to our efforts. Now, this is the...
You didn't then come in much great conflict with the OBU?
No, we didn't. Our people didn't join the one big union because we were separate and apart. We weren't... we had some of our classes in the Transcona shops. Some of them were members of the one big union, but on the whole, we maintained our position there. And actually, one of the fellows that was in the OBU became a general chairman of our organization some years after, a chap by the name of Tommy McGregor. Very good boy at that. Now you've got here, that's the story in the one big union, as far as I know. The Canadian Labour Party is something that I was never associated with. And as I said before, I was associated with the Independent Labour Party. At one time, my Woodsworth came to me and he said, I haven't any money, and the Conservative Party is going to run a candidate against me in North Winnipeg. And some colleagues of mine, and we went to work and we raised all the funds necessary for Woodsworth's campaign. They couldn't get any support from the AFL unions on that because they were strictly non-political in every sense of the word. But the workers were way ahead of the union and they would support the Woodsworth election. And Woodsworth being a very, very fine man. That brings us down to the Workers' Unity League. Now, the Workers' Unity League was an institution set up by the Communist Party of Canada for what motives, you can guess as well as I can, but it was, I presume, based on trying to get some sort of unity under the guidance and direction of the Communist Party. And it faded out of existence by the attempts to bring about unity again with the AFL. So they turned all their Workers' Unity League membership into various AFL unions after due course and decision and so forth. Two books were published at the time, at that time by Tim Buck. One was The Road Ahead and What We Proposed by Tim Buck. And in one of those books, the Communist Party made an exception off the CBRT because it was a progressive type of organization and so forth, but all the rest had to be united in the AFL. But in the very next book, you see, which came out afterwards, this direction of the Communist Party was changed with the, and that we were to become part of the American Federation of Labor. We were to be destroyed and united into an AFL Union of the Brother Railway Clerks. But that was a wish that didn't go very far. We smelt it right under the gun and we were able to stop any break at all in that direction. Before, as far as we were concerned.
Before the Workers' Unity League, there was another organization in the States. It was called the Trade Union Educational League.
That was around all right, but it never got any hold here. There were some meetings, the Trade Union Educational, I don't know, was League, was it League, called? Yeah. It issued and put around some circulars that I've seen in my day, but I've never found where they actually ever had any real locals. Probably the Workers' Unity League was it, rather than the United States. I don't know if they had the Workers' Unity League in the United States. They might have the other one. Well, it was Foster. Well, William Z. Foster was running one over there, so I'm sorry.
The Trade Union Education League was the boring from within organization.
Yes, well, this would be...
Workers' Unity League came in the 30s.
Yes, it probably was. There were always, you say, boring from within, but so far. Now, you're down here somewhere where you talk about the ACCFL. The Brotherhood was kicked out of the Trades and Labor Congress of Canada in 1921 because it was a dual organization to a rising union in the United States known as the International Brotherhood of Railway Clerks. It was under, at that time, it was under a chap by the name of, I think his name was Fitzpatrick, I think, or something like that. I can't forget his name now. But it was a rising union, and long before Harrison, the present top man in it, who recently was there, came over the picture and stabilized that situation over there. And there was a chap named Adam Hay, who was the vice president prior to Frank Hall. Frank Hall succeeded Adam Hay, and these vice presidents kept up a constant war against the Brotherhood, and of course we kept up constant war against them, and and one of our weapons at the time was not to be isolated. We called together a group of miners who were in the Canadian Miners Union and pressmen in Toronto. There's a few odd little Canadian unions in the country, and the one big union, and we brought them together and we formed the ACCFL, and with that weapon in our hands we carried on our war against the AFL, and always preaching industrial organization. And then of course CIO started to develop in the United States, and of course crossed our borders, and you have general elections in Ontario to keep the CIO out of Ontario, and Hepburn won the election, but the CIO didn't seem to defeat it at all. It seems it was peace after that. Hepburn was the first one to recognize the CIO in the General Motors in the East. So the CIO was part of the Trades and Labor Congress until once again the industrial organization came in conflict with the craft organizations, and eventually the Trades and Labor Congress voted the CIO unions out of the Congress. I think this way it split up in the Niagara Falls, or And now we had a group of industrial unions in steel and rubber and so forth. And the people in the ACCFL, including the Brotherhood, got together and developed the CCL, the Canadian Congress of Labor, and carried on in that way until they got together in the Canadian Labor Congress.
Just going back a minute, what was behind the split in 1936 between when the ACCL broke up into the CFL?
No, the Canadian Federation of Labor was a way back in the early 1910s, 11s, or 12s, or 14s, and the Canadian Federation of Labor was one of those that came into the form of the ACCFL.
But in 1936, when Burford and David...
This was Burford, of course. The ACCFL and the Brotherhood was led all these years by A.R. Mosier, and A.R. Mosier was a straight-shooting, honest, progressive guy. And Burford decided, as the treasurer of the Congress, decided on a policy of sweetheart agreements and almost developing what we decided was a racket. And personally, I fought this thing in Toronto, and M.M. McLean was in Ottawa at that particular time as the Secretary Treasurer of the Brotherhood, and he fought with Burford. And Burford resigned from the OBU was out of it by this time, out of the Congress, and Burford resigned from the Congress, and I think he set up something himself in direction, kept on running a paper soliciting advertising and got a lot of support. And during the somewhere along the way, he issued the War Worker. I guess that was in the Second War. And it was a type of labor racketeering that didn't hurt the workers, but probably took some money out of the coffers of the employers. But this was the decent. Mosier and McLean and myself weren't standing for this kind of almost strike-breaking tactics of Burford's. And this is what was broken up about.
They went together and formed the Canadian Federation of Labor.
No, the Canadian... Yes, I think then that... the Canadian Federation of Labor had been absorbed in the ACCFL. Then he went back and formed another organization. Whether he called it the Canadian Federation of Labor again, I don't know. And one of the OBU fellows, I think, played around with Burford there a bit, because the OBU then had developed into a gambling institution in baseball and got pretty I'd say low down on the standpoint of trade union. I think Bob Russell was kept a pretty straight path, but. Even then, I think that Bob had to compromise on some things. I noticed that you're asking a question here about the unemployed associations. During the Depression, we formed there was all kinds of efforts made to take care of this, the unemployed. They made a tramps out of a lot of men and also a lot of women. And they finally found out that by, should I say, organized traveling, they'd get off in a small town and by their very numbers, you see, would go and ask for food, and one would go to get tea, another sugar, and something else of that nature. And, of course, the town was glad to get them out of town, and they would gather this stuff up and get on the next freight train. And it wasn't uncommon to see a freight train with hundreds of these transient workers, which no police in a small town or railway police could handle a situation of that kind. So they roamed back and forth on top of boxcars and that kind of thing. And then the government established in Manitoba, they had it out here too, I think, relief camps. And in this, the government paid $5 a month to the people working in these relief camps. And then they had another program of giving the farmer who would take any one of these unemployed, they'd give the farmer $5 and the worker $5 for him to work on the farm. And there was people in the cities that many of them under relief, and there was relief stations opened and where people could eat, soup kitchens, you might call them, and mass feeding, as it were, so the people wouldn't starve. So in Winnipeg, we formed the Unemployed Association, and Bob Russell was the chairman, and I was the secretary. And we had various organizations that that helped us. Some, of course, the old AFL, and from the reactionary point of view, just didn't do nothing. And we run a decent unemployed association, and we take up the problems of unemployed, and we see that those relief stations were operated well. The monotony off the food, knowing what they were going to get every Tuesday or every Friday or so forth, was something that bothered them. But on the whole, we used to go down on an inspection. You see? And of course, we'd advertise they were coming down, and the net result is that at least every effort was made to lift the whole standard, so that by the time we got there, I never found much fault. Matter of fact, I always enjoyed any meal that I ever got there, as a matter of fact. The workers used to find fault with us advertising. They wanted to get out and catch them, as it were. Of course, our philosophy was by advertising, they'd clean up everything and get it in good shape, and all this would start off all right. But if you get you get bacon being cooked for mass people, it would be, you know, more or less boiled in fat, you see, where it's laid all out. It was very good quality stuff, but it wasn't the crisp bacon they'd get in the individual frying pan, so therefore they'd say it was half cooked, etc. and so forth. But we found that the food that they got was very, 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 very good as far as we were concerned. So this is what we did with the Unemployment Association. I had nothing to do with the post office sit-down demonstration anywhere.
Just before you leave the 30s, you were semi-recognized as CBRT. You had a form of recognition. Did you lose this at all during the 30s?
No. As a matter of fact, we established this relationship with the railway company, and to the credit of the railway company, they scrupulously lived up to the collective agreement during that period of depression. Probably more so than I've noticed even at other times. This is one thing that I always gave the railway credit for, where our wage cuts were 10% and 15%. My own wages in the organization were cut 35%, but the railway's attitude was, and very often, you see, allowed us to operate almost what you might call a hiring hall. They'd come to us and say, who's laid off, or in other departments, and so forth. You'd go and get these people as the thing was needed. The interesting part of it is it's a few years ago now, I guess the time goes so fast, but I remember one fellow saying to me, you know, Elroy, I remember when I come down here and to work for 1 hour a day, and was glad to get it. This was the environment of the time.
The people who stayed employed, the ones that didn't lose their jobs, how well off were they, relatively?
Well, the people that had their jobs probably were not well off, because wages were cut. Railway wages were not particularly high, and when you get down to the point where you were getting 35 cents an hour, many workers lost their homes or got quit claims on them, and even though a moratorium was established by the government in most governments, as long as they paid the interest, they could hang on to their home and their taxes. If they could handle that, but there was other people in the family that were unemployed. You see, so the workers on the whole didn't enjoy any prosperity. from the time the Depression started until you got back into the war economy of the 1939-1945 war, and it took a longer time to recover from the Depression in Western Canada, because not only was the Depression in Western Canada, you know, created by such things as unemployment, things like that, but there was crop failure after crop failure in the country, and the farmers were destitute as well as the as workers. I have seen the time when I bought 55 pounds of turkey for a $5 bill, some of which I sent down east to some railway friends of mine. I also saw a farmer trying to get $5 for a 350-pound pig. I saw, we used to send out and get a crate of eggs of 12 dozen, get change out of the dollar. There were, in Transcona, you could get a dozen, you get a bushel of potatoes, you bought a dozen oranges.
If the prices were so low, wouldn't the fact that you get a 15% wage cut and the prices drop by half, wouldn't that give you...
You see, is relative to the fact that probably everybody was supporting somebody else, you see. I, for instance, had my brother with me who wasn't earning any money at the time, you see. And this, while it was easy to feed somebody, you still had a lot of things that weren't cut in price, such as your coal bills, you see. Rents probably depreciated, but there was still the problem of taxes and interest and people that had their homes. And on the whole, there was nobody well off, you see, no matter who he was, in my judgment, during those Depression years, because they were very, very difficult years. I presume even the capitalist didn't have any fun, because he was doing his damnedest of probably trying to hold it. Trust companies, for instance, while they would foreclose on a building, they wanted to get rid of them. They didn't want to keep these houses. And if you had any money at that time, you could have bought from the trust company and get a pretty good bargain in a house without any trouble. This applied in Toronto as well as Winnipeg and so forth. As a matter of fact, I bought a house myself in Winnipeg, and I realized that all I could do if I sold it, all I could get out of it would be enough money to pay what I owed. So I decided to buy a bargain for myself and keep my own house. And for a good many years when I was in Toronto, I used to send out $10 a month, you know, to pay for this house, which I run into, as a matter of fact, the wartime housing rental control. And I'd rented my house at a very low rent at the middle of the winter. And I was getting, I think, $30 to $35, supposedly at rent, paying so much the rental agent, and the guy that was in the house was renting upstairs for 40 or 50. You see, this is the... But luckily, he eventually moved, and then I was able to sell the property at a better price than I would otherwise get. I didn't get out of it when I put in it. I had $1,500, I know, and I paid $1,500 in interest in order to pay off the $1,500 I owed. And it was cost me $1,500 in interest. So over the period of time that it took me to pay that, it was just $1,500 in interest. Then I asked the permanent loan company to give me a statement of it, you see, and they wrote back and said they couldn't give me a statement, it would cost me $3. So I simply wrote back and told them that I apologized profusely for asking the Canada Permanent Loan Company to give me a statement of the account without offering to pay for it. they got the point all right, but I sent them the $2 or $3, whatever it was, and I got the statement back, because it's a record of the actual interest that I paid. You see. And milestone.
You need to see false then to illustrate the book.
What's that?
That would be interesting to use to illustrate the book, almost stand of that dark.
That statement was all written out by a pen and ink. The Ottawa Treaty this is when they stopped, with, I think, the Mounted Police. R.B. Bennett stopped that summer spoke with a giant of the squad of RCMPs. Now, what else can I do for you?
I've looked over this pretty well and seen the strikes. Why does it list them?
This is one thing. What, not only the strikes that your union was involved in, but also the ones that sort of, like the Winnipeg strike and the... Were you involved at all in the longshoremen strikes on the West Coast during the 30s?
Well, I don't know. You see, you've got to have somebody that's more familiar with the whole thing. Winch, you know, the member of parliament here, he's the son of the Winch that was running the what they call the auxiliary. The longshoreman's auxiliary was operating here, which was kind of a freight handler on the dock, handling the freight from the dock to the cars, and the longshoremen were bringing it from ship to the shore, and they had this auxiliary. Now, of course, and they've got the whole thing under one setup. And Winch's father was very active in the Trades and Labor Congress at that time, and I don't suppose there's anybody living that could give you a history of the thing, except by perhaps a search in the newspapers that would give it. Because I was very young, and these people that I was associated with were older.
What about during the 30s? Did you get involved in any of the big strikes then?
The 30s. Where did you get your big strikes in the 30s?
Well, there was a big longshoremen strike in 35 or 37.
Oh, here? Yeah. No, we didn't get involved in that. I guess that was somewhere where they switched over, wasn't it? To the Bridges organization. This would be the transition in there. There's a chap around here by the name of Barry. He probably... Jim Burry.
I have his name and I phoned him up, but... He's a bit hesitant to talk with Bill Volcanic, I think. Well, you know him well?
Well, not too well. I got some acquaintance with him and so forth. But this fellow Prichette probably has a fairly good history.
Those are the two names we have.
Yeah, Prichette's a very young fellow.
Yeah, but he says he has all the stuff.
He's the head of it there. And a fine lad, a very, very fine boy. And looks very intelligent. And... I don't know whether, I'm sure Jim Burry, if his memory is good, he'd have records of knowledge because he's in between, you know, the period there.
Did you know a fellow by the name of McKinley in the ACCL and left with Burford?
McKinley?
From Vancouver, the Amalgamated Building Workers.
No, I know about the Amalgamated Building Workers in the East, you see. But McKinley don't sound like a... like a name that I know. They stayed a long while in this country. They were really old country carpenters that maintained themselves, and they had official recognition until finally they were wiped out by collective agreements with the Builders Exchange.
What was the, when the CIO had organized, what contact was there between your ACCL and the CCL? With the, say on the top level, is there...
What contact was there between the CIO and the ACC of L? Now, you're talking about the CIO in the United States?
Yeah.
Well, the CIO gave... gave us an official blessing from Phil Murray and Pat Conroy, who became the secretary of the merged organization, was a miner from Alberta, and the United Mine Workers, and he was the official director of organization for the CIO in Canada. That was the contact between the two of them. And they were international unions, see, the United Steelworkers of America, United Rubber Workers, Isaac Packing House Workers, and so forth. They were strictly United States
unions operating in Canada.
What about, here's another one. The ACCL, did you go out and organize many new unions, or did you...
Yes, the ACCL gave a foundation to much the many of the CIO. First, the ACCL organized the steelworkers at Sault Ste. Marie, and it was a going concern when it went into the steelworkers union. I organized all the full-fashioned hosiery workers in the... in Ontario, and I went over to the United States and brought over into this country the international, the Textile Workers Union of America. Sam Baron, you read where he got mixed up with the Teamsters Union there and wrote this long story some time ago. Sam Baron was the guy they sent over to take over. And then there was the oil workers, right? Organized the British American Oil Company and some more of them. And this is where the oil workers come in and took over. But these fellows would never come in here without the blessing of the Canadian Labour Congress. What I mean, they had to be asked. They didn't come in crowd note or trying to destroy. They just, the, for instance, I remember the oil workers distinctly wouldn't move until they, and the chemical workers was the same way. They wouldn't...
blessing from your organization?
Blessing the from the not the TLC, because the TLC was, they were older than that,
yes.
You see. But the ACCL, CLC, was operating with a limited number of the CIO unions.
Yeah.
And others were added after that, such as the textile workers, the oil workers, and the chemical workers union. And the people that I had on my staff, a good many of them were taken on to as the director of organization. And the people I had on my staff, a good many of them went with those organizations.
Well, one of the original reasons the ACCL was set up in its constitution was that this insistence upon Canadian organization.
Yes.
What reaction was it to bringing in the CIO International?
There was a common cause on industrial organization, and the ACCL attitude on Canadian organization was something that was used in the absence of anything better. What I mean, when waving the flag and selling a Canadian union was a good weapon that kept the ACCL floating. Of course, governments gave no encouragement whatsoever to Canadian unions. Governments were always against Canadian unions. In Ontario, this is largely because most of the appointments that government made in the Labour Department generally AFL people, and you got no Canadian union, to my knowledge, ever got any help from government. But I mean, I always felt that. I made some progress with the Department of Labor in Ontario when I was down there, largely on the basis of acting intelligently and decent and winning friendship of some of the conciliation officers that would work very hard for me in order to get some union I was working on recognized. But I think I'll stand by that statement that governments never helped the Canadian Union. They were always on the side of international unions.
Is this because they were, do you think, because they tended to be more conservative?
There was no doubt that, but probably we were always, always had the target of industrial organization. The things that we wanted are the things that are in effect today. See, an organization like the Machinist Union or the Electrical Workers now is a big industrial organization, but it was always a craft before. You go and see the number of people that where the electrical workers on the railway might have had some importance to the organization year gone by, but they've got all kinds of industrial plants organized in the IB, Brother Electrical Workers, and the same thing applies to the Machinist Union. The craft of as a machinist is a dead issue. It's a big industrial organization like the steel workers to a great extent, and the automobile workers, they're in that whole picture. So the things that we were advocating and pioneering all the way through was this Canadian industrial organization, and these were perhaps the employers might have liked the idea of perhaps a Canadian union, but they didn't like the idea of an industrial union. But anyway, whatever the reasons was, there was no help. Maybe we weren't effective enough to force an issue. But I mean, we often say that the employer always wanted a, if you had an international union, he wanted a Canadian union. If you had a Canadian union, he wanted a company union. And if you had a company union, he didn't want a union at all.
As a matter of fact, it wasn't the CIO union, it's much more, gave the Canadian divisions much more autonomy.
The CIO come in here, right at the very beginning, and established a great deal of national autonomy, which was also in line with our own thinking. So I think we say is that our thinking in our early days of the Brotherhood is the thinking now of a great part of the labor movement. Very little craft organization. I remember guys that became leaders in the OBU used to fight me and Mosier and so forth on the basis that craft unions were so much superior to industrial unions. And I remember a guy named Clancy in particular, and Alan Meikle and Bob Russell and these fellows, they were all leading in craft, and they were the ones that went for the one big union. But it was backwards. But it was a long struggle to build the Brotherhood. And as far as we were concerned, we got a very fine, clean, democratic union. Our image out here in the coast may not be as good as it ought to be, but the organization as a whole is really an excellent democratic union. A few ill-advised workers around here is not putting our image the way it ought to be. I tried to improve that while I was here, by the way.
Do you want to shut it off? I want to ask.